Hey folks, welcome to another episode of Long Shots. And today we have with us Dr. Arun Chopra, no stranger to our listeners. Dr. Chopra, welcome.
Hi,
good to see you. Good to see you after, good to see you in person after quite some time, because I think last time we spoke was in March and that was remotely.
That's right.
So
I know, great seeing you guys.
Oh no, absolutely. The pleasure is ours. And so Sharad, how's it going, man?
It's going very well, as always. I've seen you.
Yes, unfortunately,
quite
yes.
Frequently.
We have been seeing each other.
We've been seeing quite often, but I'm excited for today's chat. It's a little bit of a shift from our last few episodes where we got into the economy and interest rates and whatnot.
Yeah.
So today we'll make a little bit of a slight pivot towards healthcare and medicine, and what better time?
A lot more inward looking now.
A lot more inward looking.
And well, before we kind of were setting up this chat, like you obviously, were asking what can be the potential agenda, and the thing that I had in mind was, like we spoke in March, we discussed COVID in a fair amount of detail then, and so that is obviously something we would like to continue today. But a lot of months have passed since then, and there's a lot more probably that we know, you definitely know, about the disease, about its progression, about its potential endpoint or cure, or be it through vaccination or be it through management. A lot of things must have happened. I think you were pretty actively involved.
Yes.
Within the COVID effort.
That's
within
right.
Your healthcare center as well. You obviously come from Fortis in Amritsar. So how what's, if I ask you, like, you know, before we go into details, and how has been your read of the last 5 to 6 months since the last time we spoke?
Well, Nikhil, I must admit, this is one illness about which we knew nothing at all about 9 months back. And in 9 months, the amount of published literature on COVID, both in the formal medical press as well as in the informal lay press, is, I think, phenomenal.
Right.
I don't think people have researched any illness at such a breakneck speed.
Yeah.
As they have investigated COVID-19. So yes, we do know lots more than we knew, let's say, 6 months or so back. Having said that, that doesn't mean we know everything, because there are still lots of mysteries.
Right.
There are still lots of things we don't know about it. But at the outset, yes, we now are more sure about the means of spread.
Hmm.
We talked earlier about it being related with inhalation, related to touch, what we call fomites.
Yeah.
Like touching of surfaces or touching of objects handled by our friends or colleagues or relatives. We now know that it's more related to inhalation.
Right.
Rather than anything else, it's more aerosol mediated infection. For instance, if you were to talk to somebody for a long time, or if you are in a room where somebody is coughing or sneezing and releasing a lot of the viral particles, then if you have prolonged exposure, you get infected with enough particles.
Right.
That seeds into the nose, the throat, and gradually goes down into the lungs and causes the infection. Fomites, or objects that we handle, or surfaces that we touch, seem to have taken somewhat of a backseat.
Yeah.
You remember there was a time when everybody used to say that don't pick up the newspaper.
Yeah.
Or if you bring something from outside, some groceries, keep the can of groceries in your car for 2 or 3 days. And then remove and wash it, and with hypochlorite or alcohol, and then use it. All those things have now sort of taken a backseat.
Yeah.
And we know it's mostly inhalation.
Yeah.
Close contact, not passing somebody as you are walking.
So this more, will more not indoor. Infect
you. More indoor, more close contact. Yeah. For a prolonged period, maybe at least 15 or 20 minutes at a time.
Right.
That is the time when one gets the infection. So this is, I think, one big piece of information which we can swallow, and which has allowed some sort of relaxation in the norms being advised by governments, which is why now people are getting out, gradually going back to work, unlock number whatever is going on. And we see that things are slowly progressive towards not normalcy, I would say, but something like normal.
I think it's also a function of, like, there's, as you said, there's so much research been published obviously in the medical field, but as well as by lay press.
Right.
And I remember like during the when during lockdown one, when everybody was at home and there was no relief, you know, every day one was just being bombarded with anecdotal information through WhatsApp or through like, you know, use this or use that. So many home remedies were being suggested, but obviously this fomite hypothesis falling weaker has, I think, improved you know, the day-to-day management
that's right.
Of one's affairs.
Yeah.
That's right, because people were otherwise, you know, scrubbing their desks.
Yeah, which is not something which is viable for long.
Their pens and their keys,
yeah.
You know, everything which they thought could have been handled by someone else, they were spending the time scrubbing them with alcohol scrubs and such like things, which we now know is not very useful.
Yeah,
right. And you also mentioned outdoors. That's also big, you know, because like in terms of like just, we all know how much you are into fitness yourself. So from that perspective, it's a relief that, you know, one can actually go for a run and not worry about who's passing you, right?
Sure. If you cross somebody while you are running or walking briskly, you have almost no chance of getting infected because you need a big bolus of infection to get infected. It won't be that you just cross somebody and you'll get infected. That won't happen. So I think you can rest assured, and in fact, that's why we are encouraging more people to go out and exercise rather than staying at home and sitting in closed groups where you are much more likely to catch infection. In fact, the highest risk areas are actually offices, closed spaces, or family functions, or restaurants where there are, you know, there is limited space and lot of people, and you don't know many of the people, or even if you know them, you don't know if they are having any symptoms or not, and people tend to, you know, take a paracetamol or something and come for an important function, and then next day when they get fever, you get to know, oh, that guy is tested positive, and you spent half an hour with him discussing your business.
Yeah. How important, you know, when we talk about indoor setup, how important is like air circulation and air conditioning temperature? Because I remember amongst all these things that have happened, we also saw, I think government was trying to mandate a minimum temperature range for offices to keep. How important are these factors, even, you know, even while traveling by flight and sitting in offices like this?
See, air circulation is undoubtedly very important, because one of the first conclusions which told us that inhalation and aerosol is of great importance in infection is that if somebody who was infected was sitting in front of, let's say, window AC, then all the people who were sitting downstream to that person tended to get infected.
Yeah.
And all the persons sitting in the other direction tended to get spared. So we know that air circulation is important. So temperature, I'm really not sure. Even though this virus will not last in direct sunlight for more than 5 minutes, I don't think that we have any data to show that an air conditioning temperature of 26 versus 21 is going to bring about any material difference.
Interesting.
I don't think it will. Regarding airlines, I don't have first-hand information, but what I'm told is that in aeroplanes, circulation is actually the best. That they have, you know, those vents for pushing air in on top, and the air just goes down towards our feet, and the exit vents are at the bottom, close to our feet. Yeah. And so the air which comes from the top just settles down and is sucked out. And then about 40% of the air is again taken from outside.
Yeah.
Roughly 60% of the air is recirculated through HEPA filters, the same sort of filters which we use in operation theaters in hospitals.
Yeah.
And they tend to remove, filter out these viruses. So aeroplanes technically should be very safe.
Okay.
We don't have good data to show how much is the infection in aeroplanes, but of all the flights so far, the number of cases that has been spread through aeroplane is probably not more than a few dozen, which is a very minor number, considering the already the hundreds of thousands of people who must be traveling by air every day.
I mean, it's interesting because I think like aircrafts are not really 100% airtight as a structure also, right? I mean, there's constant air leakage in any case.
Right.
So that also probably has a factor to play. I think people were probably a bit paranoid because initially a lot of cases came through ships. So probably closed environments, so those ideas were probably extrapolated to aircrafts as well.
Yeah.
But it's very interesting when you mentioned that, there are cases where you see the infected person in front of a window air conditioner, and in the entire line of airflow, a lot of other infections happen. Because I recall, wasn't it in South Korea that there was a super spreader,
yes,
who infected 400 people, yeah, and she was actually in a restaurant. And yeah, Wall Street Journal, I think, did a very detailed story on this, where they tracked table by table how the AC and air handling units were set out around the table and how people were getting infected accordingly.
Exactly.
There were two places where she went, right? She went to a restaurant, then she went to a church.
Church,
the
yeah,
church, there was choir singing going on. So
that's right.
That, I think, for me was very definitive as well when I read
yes,
it. Okay, how,
that case, of course, became history.
Yeah.
And I think everybody who's studied this illness would have read that case.
Yeah.
And ultimately, I think she resulted in infection of indirectly over 1,000 people.
Right, right, yeah.
All these conversations we're having, we're obviously haven't yet used the word the mask. What is the significance of that? I mean, logically, it seems like, you know, whatever we're discussing, we'll talk about inhalation or aerosols, seems like a natural physical barrier.
Right.
That's about it in terms of preventing others. That's just a proper hygienic thing to do, correct? I mean, that
right,
is there more to it in terms of what the true power of masks are?
Oh, sure, I agree with you. See, the masks are the most fundamental barrier. Even if I'm not talking about an N95 mask.
Yeah.
An N95 mask is the most protective mask that most healthcare workers use when they are in very high risk areas, like in operation theaters or in ICUs, where they are doing procedures which can lead to quite significant amount of spread. But even the simple surgical mask, even a cloth mask, everything would be a barrier for an aerosol.
Mm-hmm.
See, basically you want an obstacle which should block the passage of a large bolus of infection into the airways of any individual. Because anybody, even if they have good resistance, anybody can have their immune system overwhelmed if they get such a large bolus of infection. But if you are getting only 1% or 2% of that bolus, because the rest has been filtered out by the mask, you are much more likely to avoid getting infected. Or even if you do get infected, the infection will be quantifiably lesser than it would be if you were wearing no mask. That's why I said that the spread is maximum in the casual settings.
Yeah.
Even a lot of healthcare workers don't get infected in the ICU, but get infected outside the ICU, in their dining halls or in their lounges, when they are, you know, tired after a duty, they are sitting and talking to each other. At that time, they relax and take off their mask and have tea or have food together. That is the time when it spreads. The other important thing is, I see that people don't understand mask hygiene. You know, mask has a couple of important issues to remember. One, the mask should cover both your nose and your mouth. So there are people who leave their nose uncovered, just cover their mouth. There are others who, when they start talking to you, they pull the mask down to their chin, which is the worst thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is only when you are talking that actually aerosols will be generated. Actually, the virus will come out into the air. If you are sitting quiet, not much virus will come out. So we have to believe in this mask hygiene, wherein one, it should cover your entire, nose and mouth. The other important thing is, once you've worn the mask, you aren't supposed to fiddle with it. I find this is very common. This is common even among healthcare workers, and that is where they make mistakes. You know, once you've put the mask and you've pressed the nose clip and made it as a firm seal, after that you are supposed to scrub your hands with soap or with a disinfectant or with an alcohol-based scrub. And after that, you are not to touch it as long as you are wearing it. And if by chance you touch it for some reason, you are supposed to scrub your hands again before starting anything else. Supposing you take it off for having a cup of tea, you are supposed to take it off, keep it in a safe place, scrub your hands, have the tea, put it back again, scrub your hands, and then start working.
Yeah.
This is what you have to remember.
And I mean, I just wanted to like show this WhatsApp message where, there are four types of COVID personalities.
That's right.
You've seen that?
No.
Oh, yes, this is very.
So the guy who's wearing the mask properly believes in science. The guy who's not wearing the mask doesn't believe in science. The guy who just shows the nose doesn't understand science, and the guy who puts the mask on the chin believes in magic. So
he lived the longest, though.
Yeah.
You know, we talked about how, you know, how it's, you contract this disease. You know, another thing, and these are all questions that pop up occasionally amongst our discussions with friends and not professionally trained people like you, but you know, there was this theory that it affects only the older people, or right. even if it does, it's much more riskier for the older people. And then, you know, I personally saw like professional athletes who, you know, can, you can assume that they have their lungs in excellent shape. Right. They were contracting it. Thankfully, none of, you know, very few were fatal like that. But what is the age? What is the current standing on age, and how does that affect the virus? Like, is there any correlation like that?
See, you are very right that our initial belief was that the older the age, the higher the risk of contracting the disease and the higher the risk of dying due to the disease. While that is broadly true, in India, we've seen very different trends. For instance, there was a thought that kids below the age of 12 will not get this disease at all. That's no longer the case.
Right.
We've all seen small kids, even infants, getting the disease. And even though it is much more rare than in older individuals, we've seen small kids dying of the disease also. So it's not to say that they can't get the disease. However, what we found is that the predictors of poor prognosis are age more than 60 or 65, or having multiple comorbidities, which include high blood pressure, diabetes, heart disease, kidney failure, and obesity. So all these are risk factors okay. for a bad prognosis. So what we found in India is that the maximum mortality is actually not in the elderly, it's in the younger subgroups. It's in the 40 to 60 year subgroup. Even in the 20 to 40 year subgroup, we found significant numbers of very severe infections, mortalities. As you said, in our practice, we've seen athletes who got it. We have policemen who got it. We've got doctors who got it. So we've got all manner of, you know, fit individuals who got it. And we know that mortality and severe illness is twice as common in males than in females.
Mm-hmm.
But I know of at least two 25, 26 year old females who died because of this illness. So there are so many imponderables, as I said right in the beginning. We know much more, but that doesn't say that we know everything. We don't. There are lots of mysteries, and we don't know why some few people are affected so seriously. And unfortunately, I find that those who are affected most seriously, in our country at least, are often not the elderly.
Yeah.
They are the younger individuals.
Mm-hmm.
They are the 20 to 40, 50 age group individuals.
Right.
This is a surprise, and we are not entirely clear
why?
How this is happening.
I mean, you know, in terms of the nature of the disease itself, I think views have evolved a fair bit, right? I mean, I remember in the very early days, you know, this was being compared to like a pneumonia-like condition. You know, then it kind of naturally progressed into something quite dramatically different. There was a time when ventilators were kind of part of the usual protocol, but now, and you know, their deficiency or lack was thrown at policymakers as a big issue, but over time that has also fizzled out. I guess basic medical protocols have also kind of been, you know, changed. And now we also hear that, you know, there are instances where there is a very acute immune system response to COVID, which ends up killing people. Like I was reading something about this cytokine storm, you know, which kind of is responsible for a large number of serious patients getting hit by the mortality. And, you know, we also hear that there are clots which get formed, blood thinners are kind of, you know, recommended to a lot of the patients. So it's kind of suddenly taking a more cardiac or slash, you know, thrombosis kind of a picture.
Right.
I mean, it's a fair bit for anyone to digest and understand. I mean, I think what I'm also saying is based on mainly, you know, press articles. But if you have to paint a picture in terms of, you know, obviously within that there are degrees, right? You have people who get a very mild, low-grade COVID infection, couple of days of rest, they're okay. Then you might have people who, you know, who kind of gets a bit more severely hit. And then you have the severely critical, critically hit people. like if you have to like work backwards from the most serious guys, how would you kind of categorize the mechanics underlying here?
So see, what happens is, let's now talk about the number of patients who are recorded positive with us,
right,
which is now just over 6.5 million.
Right.
So if we talk about the current case fatality rate, it's about 1.7-1.8%, which means that out of every 1,000 people who get infected, about 17 or 18 people don't recover and die because of this illness, and 982 or so recover completely. So the course is that 80-85% of these people recover after a relatively mild flu-like illness.
Right.
They just have fever, sore throat, cough, some people get diarrhea, some people get other symptoms, and they recover because of that, which depending upon their total level of health and fitness can take variable number of days. I typically find young people who are in their 20s, 30s becoming okay within as early as 2 or 3 days.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there are people who take 1 week, 10 days. I have now several patients who took more than, who had fever for more than 2 weeks before they settled, even though they had no shortness of breath, no lung involvement at any time. So out of these 6.5 million people, at least 85% would have recovered, you know, without any serious illness. They just had minor flu-like illness.
Right.
Of the remaining 15%, some 10% would have moderate to severe illness, which means that their saturation fell. Some of them were not even admitted. They were given treatment at home. They were advised physiotherapy and they improved.
Right.
Some of them were admitted, especially if they had other high risk factors like advanced age or diabetes, hypertension, heart disease.
Right.
And they just needed either no oxygen or very little oxygen. Like they just needed nasal cannula to give them 2, 3, 4 liters of oxygen per minute, which is very small amounts of oxygen, and they settled with that,
right,
with the appropriate treatment. And 5% or less patients went on to very severe or critical illness, where they had extensive lung involvement, they had those so-called ground glass opacities, the pneumonia sort of illness, which is typically bilateral, involving both lungs, and those were the patients who needed either high flow oxygen or non-invasive ventilation, and some of few of them even ventilators. And in this setting, what you said earlier is very appropriate, that earlier there was a low threshold for intubation. As soon as people started getting breathless, they were intubated and put on ventilator, as we do for other illnesses.
Right.
Then there was a realization that it's very hard to get these people off ventilators. Right. And there was a time when we used to avoid the ventilator like hell. Because we thought that anybody who goes on to a ventilator will not make it.
Because there was this, I think, a New York Times video or something which talked that there was this like acute respiratory
distress syndrome.
There was a protocol there which was being implemented here. And then there was a realization that...
It's not valid for this.
Right.
Because almost 80% of the people who were being put on ventilator in the earlier days used to die.
Because of...
And we could not get them off the ventilator. Right. But then there was a realization that you should delay ventilation, and we started depending more on non-invasive ventilation and on high flow nasal cannulas, which deliver 30, 40, 50 liters of minute per minute of oxygen. And they seem to avoid intubation for quite some time. And many of these patients even recovered. Now we have reached a sort of balance. Now we are not entirely anti-ventilators.
Mm-hmm.
When we know a patient is sick, we ventilate that patient, realizing that we should be able to get more than half of them off the ventilator.
Right.
Not 90%, not 80%, but maybe half of them or somewhat more than that, we should be able to get out. And if we don't ventilate them at all, most of them will just die.
Mm-hmm.
But now there is involvement of other systems apart from the lungs, as we were talking about. We now know that these people can form clots in a variety of organs. This includes the lungs most commonly, but this can also involve other organs, like people land up with heart attacks, people land up with strokes, people have landed up with blindness, with the clots in their legs. all these manifestations have been presenting symptoms of COVID.
Yeah.
So this thrombotic tendency, we were not clear about earlier, but now it is well known. And we are prescribing antithrombotic drugs or blood thinners wherever appropriate. And I'm sure that is contributing in a big way to reducing the mortality with this illness, just as steroids are. Steroids take care of the immune response part, the lung involvement, and the blood thinners take care of the clotting part. And these two drugs for the cornerstone of management of sick patients, apart from selective use of antiviral drugs. Antiviral drugs, I think everybody has heard about a lot about remdesivir and favipiravir. So the maximum data, even though it's not definitive, but the maximum data that we have is for remdesivir. This is a drug which is given in an intravenous form. It's an injection, which means it can't be given at home. So it can only be given to a patient who's admitted in a hospital. And it's a potentially toxic drug, so it needs to be monitored. So, but this drug, given in the right patients, given in moderately sick patients, has been shown to reduce the progression to very severe or critical disease or person needing ventilator. So even though it hasn't been shown to give survival benefit, it has been shown to reduce the likelihood of progression to severe disease. And that also is useful, because I don't think at the moment there is any medicine which is more effective than this in this particular regard. Favipiravir, we have very little data. It's been commonly used in some countries. We don't have clear guidelines for it. People have been using it for home use, but I think we still have relatively limited data about it. And if we decide to use an antiviral drug in a patient, I would prefer to give him remdesivir rather than favipiravir. Even though this is not something over which, you know, I could put a stamp on absolutely, but this is the best evidence that we have so far. That if you feel that a person is now requiring oxygen and is going into moderate illness, has some lung involvement, if it's less than 10 days into the illness, you can think of giving remdesivir, and it may help.
That's it's fascinating. And you know, in terms of all the drugs that have made mainstream news, there was, you know, it started with hydroxychloroquine, HCl or HCQ.
HCQ.
And then, you know, then all these new names started coming in. Then the whole Russian vaccine, which seems like a mystery black box. You know, two parts to this question. One is, how does that track vaccine development? What do you think, you know, from a technical standpoint? But more interestingly and equally interestingly is your views on how it will be distributed. Even if we do find a vaccine, let's say by, you know, 2021 first half, we think like probably the first lot will go to frontline workers, which makes logical sense. But what about, how does it go into distribution and mass scale production? Those are all big challenges, right?
Yes, those are very important, very interesting questions, pressing questions. But let me start with hydroxychloroquine. You mentioned but didn't ask me. So hydroxychloroquine has been tried in three indications. One is pre-exposure prophylaxis. That means a person hasn't got the disease, but is taking it once a week for preventive purpose. Second is post-exposure. That means the person just met somebody who had the disease and now has quickly started taking it. And the third is for treatment purposes. That means the person is symptomatic and is COVID positive. So the last two indications haven't been really supported by the data so far, even though those studies can't be called definitive, but they are, you know, the WHO study and other studies haven't found good data to support that. The only data which we have is for pre-exposure prophylaxis, which is what ICMR had recommended in India, that all healthcare workers and all people who are exposed to the disease take 400 mg tablet once a week for a long-term basis, which many doctors are taking and many other healthcare workers are also taking. Again, that has not been proven, but that is one scenario in which chloroquine might have a role. Having said that, you know, I would like to close this issue here, because I can't really take a stand about this. I'll just mention you one quick bit of information, that in countries where hydroxychloroquine is approved for use, the mortality and morbidity of this disease is far lower than in the countries where it is not available for routine use, And the biggest comparison you can see is between India on the one hand and US on the other hand,
mm-hmm.
where they don't have easy access to chloroquine and have a mortality rate which is much higher. So I will put this to rest
sure.
here
yeah.
because we don't have solid information about this. Let's
but,
move
but,
to vaccines.
Is it part of the is it part of the protocol in
what?
India?
In India,
HCQ
yes.
use.
In India, for all cases presenting with mild to moderate illness, we are generally using chloroquine. Most centers,
right.
even though all centers have their own protocols, but most centers are using hydroxychloroquine, doxycycline, and ivermectin. They are using at least one or two, and some are using even all three of these drugs. And different protocols are there in different
right.
states and different institutions. But these three drugs are included in most protocols.
Right.
So coming to vaccines.
Yeah.
Vaccines is very important. We have no good vaccines for most RNA viruses.
Yeah.
And most vaccines which have come up took years of development and are not great. For instance, we have great vaccines for some illnesses, like let's say hepatitis B. We have a very reliable vaccine. I got my hepatitis B shot when I joined my post-graduation nearly 30 years ago.
Mm.
And I still have antibodies against hepatitis B after 30 years. So those are good, reliable vaccines. You get a course once and you are protected for a lifetime. We don't have such vaccines for most RNA viruses since they tend to change with time. They tend to mutate with time. So for instance, AIDS. We still have no vaccine for AIDS after more than 35 years
yeah.
of trying to develop one. So I'm not at all certain that we'll get a vaccine in 1 year's time. Even if we do, the threshold which is kept for approval of a vaccine is not extremely high. It is only that if you give a person two doses of the vaccine 1 month apart, this person has an immune response which is thought to be of a protective level that will last for at least 6 months after the second dose. And this immune response will be present in at least 75% of individuals in a large trial. So this is not a very ambitious target. 75% people getting an immune response lasting 6 months. That's a very basic threshold. And even if a vaccine is to pass this, it should get approved. So having said
but
that
means every 6 months you...
I don't know when it will need to be repeated because we don't have data yet to
right.
see how long this immune response lasts.
Right.
Maybe it lasts only 6 months.
Right.
Maybe it lasts 1 year. Maybe 2 years.
Right.
That we'll know with time. But it is also possible that this immune response may die off in 3 months.
Hmm.
So when 6 months later, we check the immune response, and if it is not maintained, then it means that we start again. Then it means these set of trials are negative.
Yeah.
So we need to know that these vaccines are not only effective, but also safe.
Yeah.
They should not cause any inappropriate side effects. And they should be effective at least for some time. I know at the moment people are desperate. They think that if they get a vaccine which is effective even for 6 months, it's worth it. I'm not so sure
mm-hmm.
because that will see 75% protection lasting a few months doesn't mean that you can forget about COVID.
Yeah.
You will have to stay with it. You will have to keep it in mind. You will have to wear masks.
So just to be clear, like all the trials which are going on as we speak, like we hear of like AstraZeneca trial, phase 3, they all have to achieve this threshold?
Yes, they have to
at
achieve
a bare minimum.
Some, whatever threshold has been defined in each trial, it will be something on
something
these
along
lines.
Those lines, right?
And let's say if we talk about the Oxford trial, which has
yeah.
gained a lot of press in India,
yeah.
It was started in July, I think. And if its second dose would have been completed in September, October,
right.
because 30,000 people were to receive that vaccine, so it will take at least 1 month
right.
to vaccinate 30,000 people, and then 1 month later you again vaccinate mm. them. So probably by end of September or early October, this phase would be complete. And now you see they will measure the immune response after 6 weeks
right.
to make sure that they still carry the immune response, the
right.
antibodies against it. And then again at 6 months, which is why I don't understand how we can say that we can have a vaccine anytime before March and April. Because if you arithmetically add these, we can't have the 6 month result before March or April. And how can we have a vaccine in December? So unless somebody is using some other criteria for getting this vaccine approved, I'm not sure how a vaccine can even be, you know, posted for approval before April.
Right.
If you just look at this, I'm sure it would be obvious to you. After that, you see, it's a huge task. You know, on the one hand, you have vaccinated 30,000 individuals. Now you need 7 billion vaccines if you are to potentially vaccinate the entire world. Now, India is the largest vaccine producer in the world. The Serum Institute is the largest vaccine producer. And even then, I'm not sure whether they'll be able to produce 500 million doses in a year, maybe somewhat more. Even then, it leaves so many people who will still need the vaccines. Then how will it be distributed within the country, within states? How will people be allotted? Will it be quotas? I really don't know.
Yeah.
Then how much of it will be sold in India? How much will be exported? So these are all imponderables, and governments and other regulatory authorities will have to take these decisions, which I am not qualified to take. But these are some of the questions which we need to think about.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of, like you keep on hearing of vaccine diplomacy, right? That there are, I mean, a lot of countries are talking to each other to kind of have those kind of contingency plans. But I mean, there's also, I mean, to be fair, your take on vaccines as we speak, I mean, one is obviously the timeline, March, April next year. And secondly, the efficacy is again something which needs to be seen.
Absolutely.
Thirdly is frequency, then there's distribution. Seems like the vaccine card is being overplayed quite a lot.
I guess so. I don't think you can think of it as a one-time vaccine which you get once and then it's over with.
Yeah.
Not at all.
Yeah.
So after, you know, thinking about safety, efficacy, how often to use, you finally have to find a vaccine.
Yeah.
See, on the one hand, I'm talking to you about practical issues, about how millions and millions are going to need it, and nobody seems to know how it will be available, where it will be available. On the other hand, already, you know, I'm getting off the record feelers from people who claim that they already have doses of vaccine ready to be injected from the Serum Institute. I'm sure that's a scam which some unauthorized people are trying to carry out, because these trials are done very, very meticulously and very carefully.
Right.
And they would obviously not allow any official vaccine to be available in the gray market.
Yeah.
So this must all be a scam carried out by unscrupulous people. And I think I would suggest the listeners that they look at any such deals or any such offers very carefully, as long as the government doesn't issue a proper guideline that this vaccine is approved in the market for clinical use.
Yeah.
Please don't get any unauthorized market vaccines on the gray market and get any injections. We don't know what they are and what sort of effects they can have.
Is there a possibility that by the time the vaccine comes into the market for commercial, for, you know, mass production scale, we would have achieved some kind of automatic herd immunity by then?
Yes, that is a distinct possibility. Though this pandemic has taught us that nobody can predict anything reliably. And anybody who has predicted anything, you know, has been laughed at a month or two later. But if you look at the trends for September, you can see in first week of September, we started noticing that almost everyone we know has a family member affected. And this sort of means that, you know, virus is out in the community. And this is sort of peaking, because anybody you know, people who studied with me in school, who were with me in medical college, who were with me in hospital, people I know, people I meet in the market, you know, everybody has it. Everybody has somebody or the other in their family who is diseased. So what do you mean? When does a disease peak? This is the disease peak. So see, ICMR a few days ago announced that for every one case that we diagnose, we are missing up to 80 to 130 cases. That means they expect that the number of cases is 100 times more than the number of positive cases. So the positive cases are already 6.5 million. According to their figures, at least 50 crores would already be exposed. even if we take a very conservative estimate, we believe that we are missing 20 or 25 people for every one person who is diagnosed. The real numbers of infected cases would mean at least around 150 million or 200 million, which is a huge number. So I'm sure close to 40-50% of the population, if they haven't got the disease, they've at least been exposed to it.
Right.
Because somebody in their family had it. And they stayed with them for several days and didn't get the illness. It means that they have some sort of immune response which is protecting them.
Right.
So I think perhaps in another few weeks, we would be reaching those critical thresholds of 50 to 60% or more positivity, which would lead to herd immunity. I am hoping, and this is hoping with my fingers crossed, that in a month or two, we'll see a continuation of this trend. I think the downtrend took place around 18th or 19th September. After that, we are seeing a consistent decline of active cases. Around 18th, the number of active cases were in excess of 10 lakhs.
Yeah.
Now it is about 9 lakhs. That's 9 lakhs, 10,000 or something like that. So there is a decline of 1 lakh active cases over the last 3 weeks or so. Furthermore, if you look at the mortality trends, there was a time when we were getting more than 1100 deaths per day. So real number of deaths must be somewhat higher, because if we are missing so many million cases, we would also be missing some mortalities. But let's look at the official number of mortality figures. So the official number was 1100 odd every day for the last several weeks. And if you see in the last week or 10 days, we've come consistently below 1,000. And now, in fact, we are in the 700, 800 per day range. So once you have a decline in total number of confirmed cases, which from 1 lakh a day nearly have come to about 70, 75,000 per day, you have an increase in recovered cases. Every day you have more recoveries than new cases. So the net number of active cases in the community are decreasing. Even the mortality has started decreasing now, shows that herd immunity does seem to be perhaps kicking in.
I mean, you kind of seem to have a view that this dip is a trend.
This is a trend. And while I will not go as far as to say that we'll see the, you know, finishing of this epidemic in the next couple of months, because in 1918, 100 years ago, when the last time there was the Spanish flu pandemic, there was a second wave and there was even a smaller third wave.
Yeah.
And evidently the second wave was worst, which is perhaps what we are seeing in Europe now.
Yes.
We are seeing in England and Spain and France, we are seeing it come back. So I shudder to think winter is round the corner. I hope we don't get something like that here. But I seem to think that from the trends that we are seeing, we have now a pretty large distribution of cases
technically had a second wave. Our first wave has
wave has, you know, sort of merged into the second wave.
Yeah.
Our first wave was flattened so much by the prolonged and strict lockdown that perhaps it has merged into the second wave. The second wave would have happened when from the villages. Because when, you know, the city people got okay and the rural people started coming into the cities, that's when rural people would also start getting the disease. I think that started about 6 to 8 weeks back.
Yeah.
And now rural India is pretty much involved.
Yeah.
So now Maharashtra has seen a second wave and is going down.
Yeah.
Delhi has seen a second wave and is going down. Punjab has seen the first wave, which is now going down. So I'm hopeful that over the next 6 to 8 weeks, we'll see a significant decline in this illness. However, what happens when winters come is anybody's guess.
Sure, because that those conditions are also probably more conducive. But like, I mean, so it seems like, you know, if the vaccine prognosis is slightly, I would say, I mean, I won't say grim, but maybe slightly cynical or realistic. Do you see, like, and you were talking about RNA viruses, how it's usually has been a tough challenge. You specifically mentioned AIDS.
Right.
And AIDS obviously led to some permanent lifestyle changes over the past 3 decades.
Right.
Do you see a parallel in case of COVID as well? Like, masks would become the norm? I mean, these are all very open-ended, traditional-oriented questions, but I mean, I just want to learn
I guess
your take.
So. Right. I guess so. Because see, more effective than any vaccine today is a good fitting mask.
Yeah.
So if all we do is wear masks when we go out, as has already been the norm in several East Asian countries, in Japan and in China, in several countries, when people go out on the road, they wear masks.
Yeah.
So if we were to just enforce this, we may, you know, go a long way in controlling this disease. Today, a good mask worn well is probably more effective than any vaccine we have on the anvil at the moment.
Right.
Things might change in the future, but as of now, wearing a good mask, you know, staying careful about your surroundings and keeping your hands clean, these would be the most important guidelines today. And I'm hoping that these are followed with time, because this disease does appear to be here to stay, just as the common flu is. So if it gets wiped out like the Spanish flu, that'll be great. I'll be very happy, but that may not happen. Yeah. And so we should be prepared for the long haul to respect masks and to respect hand cleaning for you know, all the important benefits that they have.
I think this is obviously slightly... there's a lot of overwhelming information as well, in addition of being underwhelmed, because these permanent lifestyle changes do have their own economic, psychological costs. A lot of things have now people been familiarized with. But no, let's see. This has been incredibly interesting to kind of, you know, touch base on the topic after a designated kind of period of time to learn how things have changed. Oh, thank you so much for your time and for your insights.
Yeah, certainly enjoyable, and it's good to touch base and get a good update from someone who's been working on this issue.
So in person.
In person.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
It's always great being here with you guys and talking on this forum. Thanks.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Our pleasure. Definitely. And so with this, I think we can sign off today's episode. As Sharad in the beginning said, slightly different from the, I think last two episodes we were covering fintech in a lot of detail. Today we kind of went into, we were highlighting earlier, something more inward and something much more deeper. And,
listen, you got to invest if you want to afford that vaccine. At the end of the day.
Exactly. So you got to respect the markets as well, along with your own health. But no, this has been great. And with that, this is Nikhil Arora.
This is Sharad Tupran.
Signing off.